How can we make the internet safer for children? Is the web really as dangerous as we think? The answers to these questions and more on a special extended episode of Radio Berkman. Nearly a year has passed since the Internet Safety Technical Task Force began research on a set of recommendations for parents, industry, and government to make the web safer for minors. The task force, launched by the Attorneys General of 49 states and coordinated by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, just released its recommendations and some statistics that defy the conventional wisdom about risks to minors online. Looking at data regarding sexual predation, access to explicit content, and cyberbullying, the report finds that children and teenagers are not likely to be lured into sexual situations by adults online. Minors at the greatest risk online typically already engage in risky behaviors or face other psychological or life troubles offline. Findings such as these fly in the face of expectations of a media culture saturated with shows like To Catch a Predator and recent high-profile cyberbullying cases. But the exhaustively researched 278-page report, funded in part by MySpace and other industry leaders, also has some powerful recommendations for dealing with safety hazards for minors where they do exist. David Weinberger visited the offices of two of the coordinators to find out more about their groundbreaking report. John Palfrey is the chair of the Internet Safety Technical Task Force, as well as a Harvard Law professor, a faculty director of the Berkman Center, and co-author of the recently released book Born Digital. Dina Sacco is the co-director of the task force, as well as a fellow at the Berkman Center and former assistant U.S. attorney. You can find a link to their report on our website at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
The task force came about as a result of a joint statement between 49 state attorneys general in the United States and MySpace, the company that runs one of the biggest social networks in the world. And there was a subsequent agreement between those same attorneys general and Facebook. And one of the promises that everybody made to one another is to convene over the course of roughly a year, not even actually a year, we started our work really in February of 2008, a task force that would bring together child safety experts and companies, along with technologists and researchers and others, to try to answer the question, what can we do using technologies based on the best research to help make kids safer online? I think one of the key concerns is that many attorneys general are seeing in their day-to-day work prosecuting child predators a number of people who are online and who are seeking out young people to meet them offline and to do terrible things to them. There's a real concern about the extent to which the online space has become a zone in which predators find their way toward kids and that they then do bad things to them. So that's one category, unwanted contact, as they describe it. The other thing that they were concerned about was the continued access to online content that might be harmful to kids one way or another. So the charge that we had really was to look at these questions of unwanted contact and unwanted content for kids and then to say, what are the things that technology can do as a way to make kids somewhat safer in those dimensions?
So there's obviously been a huge amount of media attention paid to these problems. Dina, you began with a review of the literature.
Initially, the task force decided to form two advisory boards to advise it in its work. There was a technical advisory board and as well as a research advisory board. Dana Boyd chaired the research advisory board, and she convened a group of the leading researchers in the field to delve into all of the known literature on youth online safety issues to date, to both identify what we know about youth online safety and where there are voids in the research, where there are holes in the research.
This literature review that Dana Boyd and the Research Advisory Board did was the first I know of to try to roll up all the research that we know has been done in peer-reviewed studies about keeping kids safe online. And so I think one of the big contributions of this report is to have in 85 pages or so a consolidated, serious piece that says, this is what the research tells us. These are the risks that kids are facing. Here are some of the relative concerns people have. And it was done by Dana, and also a great guy named Andrew Schrock is the co-author of that piece.
So here we have a media environment that we're all familiar with, where there's a great deal of concern and fear about what's going on online, child safety online. You've now done a review, as complete as you can make it, of all the peer-reviewed solid scholarship that actually looks at this and gathers actual data, not just anecdotes. You think you've covered everything you can find?
I'm totally certain that we have covered all the available and appropriate research that has been conducted on large scale. That said, there are holes in terms of what we know and what we don't know. But I think one of the things that sets this task force apart is that it was a research-driven effort, which was to say, with open minds, what are the things that we in fact know based on good quality methodology studies, and then to say on the basis of that, what technologies exist out there and how can we deploy those technologies to keep kids safe based on real risks.
What do the data say?
So the data say good news and bad news on different topics. The good news on the topic is modest, but I think important to note, which is that studies show consistently that it's not getting worse. In fact, it might be getting marginally better for kids. This is a provocative finding, of course, but if you look at the studies from 1990 to today, the likelihood that a kid is going to be abducted and sexually harmed is lower than it was over that period of time. And that obviously spans the period during which the internet has made its ascendancy. It's still an abhorrent and terrible crime. It is something we have to work on with lots and lots of strategies and with everybody doing what they can. The nature of the crimes has not changed. The only thing that's changed is that sometimes, it's true, the first contact happens in online environments. And very often it's at-risk kids, just as it has been at other times. So it's rare to say there's any good news in an issue as terrible as sexual predation, but I think it is important to note that the rise of the internet hasn't given rise to a huge spike in the extent to which this is happening to kids. So that's number one. The second one around content is, I think, that many of the studies have been fairly consistent about this, which is that young people do get access to pornography through the internet, of course. We know that sometimes they are looking for it. Young people do, particularly males, look for pornography online. We also know sometimes they get access to it in unwanted ways, and that's unfortunate. I think the most recent studies show that there might be a small decline in the extent to which young people are getting unwanted access to pornography. We know this is a way that it happens, and there are a lot of different strategies for addressing that concern. The area where there's real change and real dynamism in the research is in the area of bullying online. So we know that there's a fair amount of peer-to-peer harm, sometimes sexual in nature, sometimes it's not, and there has been a big uptick in that area. It's hard to say that there's an uptick overall in bullying, so we don't necessarily know that there's more or less on the schoolyard as a result of what's happening online, but we certainly know that kids are being psychologically harmed, and fairly dramatically so, by some of their peers online, and sometimes it's of a sexual nature. So that clearly is an area where there's rising concern, and something that we think this report draws out is to say, look at what we're seeing in this research here as a possible area of concern.
When you say the percentage of children encountering predators of one sort or another seems to be dropping, if anything, dropping a bit. What's the range of percentage that we're talking about?
Obviously, yeah. Any percentage of kids is bad and abhorrent, and we want to prevent that. The question is, where does the law enforcement emphasis need to be? I mean, I think part of what the research has shown is that in many instances of sexual predation, the kids are in some instances knowledgeable that the person that's approaching them is older and that understands that they're meeting them for purposes that may be sexual. And so that doesn't mean that it makes the crime any less abhorrent. It just means that the focus needs to be on educating kids, and that your emphasis needs to be in a different place than it would if it was a younger child sort of taken unawares by a predator.
As we note in the report, most of the studies that have been done over time across these different contexts show a decline in the likelihood that someone is going to be approached for sex online as a young person. So I think important salient studies done by the University of New Hampshire and funded by the DOJ and relied upon by NCMEC and others show that the percentage of youth who receive sexual solicitations online has declined from 19% in 2000 to roughly 13% in 2006, and that most of the recipients, 81%, are between 14 and 17 years of age. So that's kind of the backdrop data. There is new data coming out this spring that I think will show a consistent trend in this direction. That doesn't make it okay that it's still happening, of course. I think what we should do in reacting to those numbers and to these data is to say, what are the things that are being done that actually are working? That's what we should celebrate, right? So I think that the things that the research suggests is that educating kids, giving them better tools to handle these solicitations when they come, and they're often from peers, not necessarily from older people, as it turns out, give them those skills for how to respond to it, give them ways to do it. And what I've seen in my own research in doing interviews with kids, the kids who have been online longer know to avoid these kinds of situations and also to screen them out to some extent. They develop skills and then with their own peers they figure out how to do it. I think the attorneys general deserve a lot of credit for this. Frankly, they've been out in schools talking to parents and to teachers and to kids about keeping themselves safe online. These are things that I think we can point to as clearly getting some traction and helping keep kids safer online.
Is there room for introducing technology to help with this? Age verification is often talked about, for example.
There's enormous room for technology to play a role here. It would be a total mistake, according to what we've found over the course of the year, to rely on technology alone. So I think it's very important to say the task force has reiterated the fact that technology needs to work hand in hand with law enforcement, needs to work hand in hand with education, needs to work hand in hand with lots of different strategies on a local, national, international level to keep kids safer. But technology certainly plays a role. One of the things we did with this task force was to invite technology companies to present to the task force, some of whom were on the task force itself, what they were working on, and then to evaluate it. So we had over 41 submissions of technologies to the task force in a formal setting. We then analyzed them according to their ability to help on certain fronts. And the short answer is absolutely. Technology does play a role, can play a role, and will play a greater role over time as a result of putting it into sort of a suite of tools to protect kids as they go online. And then on the other side, of course, giving kids the skills to use those tools as a way to keep themselves safer.
Do you have a speculation about why bullying has not been at the top of the list? This was an area of concern that you had to find rather than being one that was proposed to you to look at?
I think that initially when the task force began in February, bullying wasn't sort of at the forefront of anyone's mind. The research certainly started to show that that was becoming more and more of an issue. But in the intervening time, we had at least one very highly publicized case involving cyberbullying that resulted in a federal criminal prosecution, the Lori Drew case. And so I think that I believe it would be fair to say that now bullying and harassment are more concerns for parents as well as for law enforcement. And I think that perhaps the task force was looking at the research and seeing that this was going to be an area that was that going forward was going to become more and more important.
It's not something that you often prosecute, right?
Right.
It's not something that law enforcement is focused on, how one kid treats another kid. And I think part of what we're describing here is that there is really a spectrum here of bad ways that kids treat one another, basically. And sometimes it does involve sexual advances. Sometimes it crosses over the line into something you might have think of as unwanted contact as well. And I think the strategy here is really to say there's kind of a spectrum of harms, and we need different types of solutions to work together to keep kids safe in these distinct and often quite fine-grained situations.
None of these things, sexual predation, bullying, exposure to problematic content, are new. They're just put into the context of the internet, put in a slightly different context. But kids have been exposed to all of them since well before the advent of the internet. And the point of the task force was looking at them in this context to think about how they arose in this context and how they might need to be approached differently because of the difference in context.
But surely the internet makes it easier for, let's say, a sexual predator to predate than having to hang around in, you know, the back alleys and all the rest of that.
I think there certainly the concern with the internet is that you have availability to and exposure to a much wider world of people. But if you think about sexual predation, really it's about access to a child. And just because you can access a child, and this is actually just speaking off the top of my head, in my experience as a former federal prosecutor, less than as a task force co-director. There are fewer instances involving the internet where then you might actually get access to that child. There would have to be travel involved. There would have to be proximity. And I think one of the research points that that the report points out is that it remains that what we know about sexual predation is that children are in much more danger from people that they know directly in their lives, from people in their families, from people in their schools. The stranger danger is a misnomer.
Right. I mean, I think the point is what is the public park has changed, right? The public park is often an online space owned by a private vendor where predators can get easy access to children by virtue of signing on, but also where children can get an easy way to deflect it. So one of the things the research shows is that over 90% of most kids have deflected without any problem the sexual advances that they get online. That this is an unfortunate fact of life, that we live in a scary world, but kids also can develop the skills to help themselves to some extent.
90% of all kids or 90% of those?
90% of those kids who were approached for sex online one way or another, defining in different ways, were able to deflect the approach without incident.
So social networking sites have gotten a bad reputation, and many parents are afraid of them. They view them as sites, as the public park at night with unsupervised kids and all the rest of it. Should parents now be less concerned about their children's participation in social networking sites?
The research shows that social network sites are actually not the most common place where kids are coming up into contact with sexual predators. It's much more frequently in things like instant messaging and chat and other environments. So one of the things we've tried to do with the task force report is to say, let's take our scope and make sure it covers the internet as a whole, that it's not just in the social networks. It's not impossible that happens,
right.
But it's important to see it as one aspect of the internet.
And I think as part of that, one of the things that the research showed was that the target of where the predation or other negative events happen changes over time as the internet evolves. So that today people might be concerned about social network sites, but that's not necessarily what they were concerned about 2 years ago, and it might not be what they're concerned about 2 years from now. And so that we shouldn't be so focused on one locus of activity.
Right, or one technology at any given point. And I think one of the meta points here is that this is such a dynamic space, both in terms of the dynamism of the risks kids face and the types of environments in which they face them and the availability of different tools to help them deal with it, that we don't think that there should be a static answer. So one of the clear findings of the task force is we don't think there should be a mandate of any technology on technology service providers to keep kids safe. The point is we need a dynamic mechanism that says, let's continue to innovate in this space, let's use best practices and find ways to make sure that the tide is always rising, but also that we're being responsive to the risks that kids face at any given point.
But by no means are we saying that parents shouldn't be concerned. Concerned in the sense that parents should be involved, and that parents should make them learn as much as they can to be knowledgeable about what happens online and how their kids use online spaces, and to communicate with their kids about that online use. Because without that, that's where the problems can arise, if the parents don't know. We also have to keep in mind that there are plenty of children for whom positive parental involvement is not really a possibility. There are many at-risk kids who don't have necessarily access to parental support. And so for those kids, we need to think about other strategies and other institutions and social services and schools that we can bring in to support them.
The internet is the primary social space for a lot of kids, and it's not separate from offline life. It's a converged life that they're living. And so I think the answer to say keep kids off of social networks is frankly the wrong one. But that's not to say that parents shouldn't be very focused on how they can keep kids safe wherever they are.
So the task force has a series of recommendations that are not to any specific sort of group of entities or individuals, but recommendations about the expenditure of resources in this area. To start with parents, although that's sort of the last set of recommendations, but it's primarily about educating themselves and becoming involved and exploring technologies that might be effective for their families in their particular situations. Not just worrying about their own children, but for considering others in their community, and for particularly minors who might be at risk, to sort of expand their horizons to think about how their communications with their own kids and their involvement with their schools can help other kids to navigate the waters of safe internet use.
When it comes to technology, we see a lot of innovation in this field. We see lots of improvement in terms of how social networks and other internet service providers are actually putting them into use. So the key thing that we think needs to happen next, in addition to all the kinds of education and other collaborative efforts, is to have some kind of a body that helps to manage the collaborative effort between technology companies and child safety experts and others around what is the best practice for protecting kids in different environments over time. I think the best possible thing that we can see come out of this is that social networks, that internet service providers and others are actually competing on safety for kids, and that by virtue of having a certain environment in which everybody's coming together and saying, look, this is a really good way to protect kids from this particular harm, we need that iterative and dynamic body to exist, and something that will continue to be sure that over time we're making progress for kids, and, you know, sharing data, setting standards, whatever it might be. I think that's a much better way to go based on what we've seen than any kind of static law-based approach. There's also much more work to be done on the research side, which is something we point to in our recommendations, but also in the review of the literature. There are some things we don't know that much about. One is we don't know that much about what, for instance, registered sex offenders do on various internet sites, including social networks. This is a gap in the research, and one where law enforcement, in fact, can help researchers by turning over some of that data so we can understand that dynamic better. Another area is it's very much under-researched, the peer-to-peer harms that are occurring. How are kids harming one another through some of these bullying type activities, often which are at the margins of sexual behavior too. So I think just as we need to put pressure on the technology companies to improve the technologies and continue to keep kids safe, the research community needs to keep figuring out ways to fill the holes in terms of what we know.
Aren't there any technologies, nevertheless, that can be recommended across the board? And for example, one that law enforcement often talks about, namely age verification. Why not just require everybody to verify their age before they join or visit a social network or other site?
We spend much of the time talking about a class of technologies that includes age verification and identity authentication, which are very related, exactly the same thing. They apply in different contexts. These are technologies that are in use in other parts of commerce. So age verification, for instance, in use to limit the extent to which young people or others can buy alcohol online, just as an example, a lot of commercial applications. Identity authentication is used in a bunch of different contexts. It's something that has lots of different applications. Potentially banks use it as one measure. So we spent a lot of time looking at this particularly mature class of technologies. The task force, I think, overall came down to say this is not the time to put all of our emphasis on age verification, in particular because much of what the research says is that there's not a lot of age-based deception in these harms. So it's not to say it doesn't work in terms of a technology. I think the providers of the technology have solved many of the issues around. It's not to say it's not gameable. Of course it is, but you know, by and large, it's in use in commerce is real. But that of the issues that we saw, that age verification isn't necessarily going to be something that's going to make a lot of difference for kids. There's a lot of dispute over this. There's disagreement within the task force on this finding, but that's one. The other is around identity authentication, and I think there are real opportunities for the application of identity authentication to increase the likelihood that kids are safe online. I think one of the concerns with doing that is the adoption, which is if you had to go into every school and have schools verify who people are and so forth, there's a complex logistical challenge. I think one of the concerns there is that at-risk kids who are not in that kind of an environment might get left out of that system and may continue to get harmed. So I think with both of those cases, there's a case to be made that there are advantages to doing it, but I think the task force overall was pretty skeptical of those two as overall approaches. I should hasten to say, though, also that Second Life, one of the virtual worlds, uses one of the age verification technologies now. So its use in commerce is real, and you know, we, I think, should be tracking where people are using it and see if it provides promise over time.
Right. Part of the difficulty that the task force found was just exactly this idea that ostensibly we can identify adults because adults have forms of identification, but minors don't. And so each of the vendors who were proposing a technology that would seek to identify minors had to have a mechanism by which they would identify minors. And many of those involve parents or schools or other institutions that have access to data and access to the minors themselves. And there was a lot of concern among task force members about how exactly that would work and the kind of burdens that it would place on an already overburdened school system.
What we tried to do with each of the technologies we looked at was to point out what are the advantages and what are the disadvantages of doing it. And I think a lot of what we've teed up with these 40-plus technologies is to say, you know, in many of these cases, these are policy choices that you can make. You can say, here are reasons to do it, here are reasons not to do it. And you know that we ought to take it from there over time, but to have some mechanism to continue to evaluate all of these approaches. And at the same time, we also highlight what's going on right now with the social networks, who's using what technologies at what time in a way that I think will help us all understand better what's working and what's less likely to work.
So this is a 280-page report. It's scholarly and academic. It's very it's non-inflammatory. It's careful. It's fact-based. It's research-based. And yet it overturns assumptions, and not just assumptions, but fears that we've been living with in our culture for over a decade now. We have an image of the scariness of the internet and the dangers to our children and at a very high level. And this report it puts us in the context of research and facts, and it turns out our fears are not exactly what they should be, nor are they at the level that is appropriate. There's undoubtedly going to be a strong reaction to this report. How are you going to respond to critics and to those who seem intent on holding on to their prior assumptions?
We'll each take a crack at this. It seems to me to be a personal response. I mean, so I think one of the key issues here is to say that the harms to any child that we've studied are horrible, right? There's no way but to be affected by these stories. They are terrible. But we also, at the same time, want to set them in the context of all the risks that people are facing and what the real problems are here that we need to try to solve. There is nobody involved in this process who isn't doing it, I believe, in the interest of protecting kids. And I think one of the things we tried to do with this report is to say, with the coldest possible eye, what are the real risks, and then what are the responses that we can bring to bear on them. It makes no sense, if you care about kids, not to be following the facts. And so I think my response to people who might see this report and say it's off base one way or another is to say, look, we have no incentive here other than to protect, in my case, my 6-year-old and my 3-year-old. I know that they're going to spend a lot of time online. They already do. I want them to have the best chance to have a great life that they possibly can. I also want them to be protected from what the real risks are. And I want the world to have the best public policy, in the spirit of protecting them. So my ultimate response is we have done the best, most honest, free of any conflict approach to this in the interest of kids. And, you know, reasonable people may disagree as to what the research says. Reasonable people may disagree as to what the right response is, what we should apply where. But I think ultimately what we've done is to try to lay the facts as barely and plainly as we can on the table and say, let's have a real conversation based on what the best research can show.
And I would reiterate all of that, although I would say minor. I have 2 children as well, but they're 8 and 5. And say there should be no misunderstanding that this report is saying we should do nothing. That's far from what we're saying. We're saying we should look at what's out there, we should continue to study it, and we should simultaneously go forward on protecting kids in the best way possible. But that the way that we might do that would involve not just technology, but education, social services, law enforcement. We certainly in the report call for a law enforcement presence, not just in the collaboration that we've talked about, but also online and in increasing law enforcement's ability to police online spaces and to be knowledgeable about what's going on online. And that too is sometimes a resource issue and a place where resources can well be spent, as I know from my own experience. That sometimes we were hoping for more resources than we necessarily had. So again, I think that the report should not be read to say, there is no problem. We absolutely believe that there's always a concern when we're talking about children's safety. And we are just trying to do the most unbiased approach that we could take in trying to figure out what's the best solution to the problem.
Dina Sacco, John Palfrey, co-director and chair of the Internet Safety Technical Task Force. Thank you very much.
John Palfrey and Dina Sacco are the chair and co-director, respectively, of the Internet Safety Technical Task Force. You can find out more about the Internet Safety Technical Task Force report and archives of past Radio Berkman episodes at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Special thanks this week go to Jennifer Gordon and Jessica Tatlock. This is Daniel Jones, producer of the Radio Berkman series at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.